whose mother is the famous atheist Madeline Mary O'Hare. He says when he was growing up, he thought his mother was the most hated woman in America, if that's what she thought she was. And in his new book, he confesses that there were times when they hated each other. She never wanted a son, his father wouldn't marry her, and Mary says he was treated viciously by his mother. He never wanted to be different from the other kids, he writes, and at the age of 14, he became the plaintiff of record when his mother brought a suit to the Supreme Court to take prayer out of the Baltimore public schools. She won the case and began an atheistic campaign around the country, in which her son became an active member. But at the age of 33, William Murray converted to Christianity. He hasn't communicated with his mother since 1977, although he says he still prays for her. And in 1980, he started his own Christian organization called the Faith Foundation. He's written a new book. It's called My Life Without God, and it's just been published by Thomas Nelson Publishers. And William Murray, welcome to Fresh Air.
Pleasure to be on the show today.
Did you hate growing up being the son of who the family considered to be the most hated woman in America?
Well, I never really wanted any tremendous amount of public exposure then and now, then or now. Our family was literally the only family that could be heard on the block. From about a block away, and there was constant arguing in the home. There was constant bickering in the home. Constant of fighting. The television was always up at a huge roar. The reason I'm saying this is because of that. There was always some attention toward our family. Whether it was the next door neighbors pointing fingers, or whether it was during one of the periods where my mother had an argument with a supervisor and been fired and was unemployed, and somebody would be coming out to repossess the furniture, you know, whatever it was, there was always that type of thing. As a result, when the Supreme Court decision came along, or when the case that wound up being a Supreme Court decision came along. I really did not have any tremendous desire for all of the finger pointing and the notoriety that came from it. I already had that, and I knew that like most people are not aware of. They think, oh, being in the public spotlight is just that must be the greatest thing in the world. But in most cases, it is not. I think that's one of the reasons you have so many performers and other people that wind up on drugs. It's the only thing they can do. They have so many people around them that they're lonely, and it's the only thing that they can do privately is take drugs or drink, and that's what they wind up doing.
The impression that you give in your book is that your mother's atheism and her association with radical politics was really just a way to vent her personal frustrations.
I think it is, but I don't think that is. I don't think that is all that highly unusual. The Ku Klux Klan headquarters in Pasadena, Texas, is located in an area where you'd expect them to be able to recruit people down where people are unemployed and miserable and blame the blacks for everything. And the Communist Party headquarters and the Nazi Party headquarters are literally across the street from each other in a slum area, because that's where they get their recruits from, people who are failing in life, and they offer them something better. I've seen the pictures that used to line the walls when it was in Virginia of the American Nazi Party, and their favorite thing to do was to show what the people looked like before they came to be Nazis, and how nice and sharp they look afterward. And man, they take Hell's Angels and unemployed people with hair down to their waist, and they'd have their pictures up there, and then beside it would be this nice, clean cut guy in a Nazi uniform. And it isn't unusual that my mother, what I'm saying is, wound up with that type of radical situation because of her background. She was involved in, she couldn't hold down a job. She was fired every 3 to 6 months, like whatever the length of a probationary period was. That's how long she lasted at a job. The longest she ever lasted, I think, was a year. with the Social Security Administration, and she lasted a year with them because their probationary period was a year.
Why do you want us to know this?
Well, I think it is. For many reasons. Number one, I think it's important that people know what happened to take prayer out of the public schools, what some of the motives were. Also, I think it's important for people to realize many of the things that actually happened during the 60s, or what people refer to as revolutionary years, when the largest bulge of population in history to hit a country, which I was a part of, and that baby boom squeezed through America, straining the facilities to the point that many people revolted against it. Classrooms that were designed for 15 kids had 40. Many people revolted against the society just out of the pressure of numbers. There were just too many people. If we would have had a bigger war than the Vietnam War, which could have taken a few million people a time out, it would have probably have relieved a lot of pressure on the society. But everything was strained. And many people that would have probably have gone through their lives without too much of a challenge wound up in tremendous competitive situations in which they couldn't handle. My mother was one of those individuals. A lot were. Lee Harvey Oswald was one. Both of them had, by the way, the same thing with trying to defect to the Soviet Union and thinking that there would be plenty of jobs there and you could never be fired, and all these other dreams about the Soviet Union and all the green pastures over there, which is a bunch of hogwash. I think it's important for people to go back and to see what happened, not to try to make the 60s, all of the 60s, look like some giant Camelot of Woodstock, and that the whole thing was like the 3 days at Woodstock, because the whole thing wasn't like that. A lot of it was terrifying and revolutionary, and buildings were bombed, and innocent people were killed, there was a lot more than what's in our history books today.
An atheist who I've interviewed on this show a couple of times and who's written extensively on atheism said about your mother that she gives atheism a bad name. I wonder if you think that she is a good representative of what atheism means to most people.
She is a representative. She might be an extreme representative, but she is, in fact, a representative of a philosophy which is nihilistic in nature. The other day, a doctor of at one of the universities here, a PhD, supposed to be a learned man, and he got up and gave me a dissertation on how well atheism worked and how beautiful it was and how everybody paid attention to their fellow man because they could decide what was right and wrong inside of them, and how we had to live for today and not live for tomorrow because there was no afterlife, there was no God, no absolute right and wrong, so we had to determine right and wrong for ourselves. And it was a very beautiful dissertation. But the thing is, I do a lot of drug counseling work. And as a result, my home phone is answered 24 hours even when I'm not there because I'm involved in that. And I had a young man who was involved in the PDAP program who had been a heavy user of hard drugs give me almost an identical argument, almost verbatim, on why he should continue to take drugs. And whenever you have a nihilistic argument, whether you use it to prove whether you're doing something properly or whether you're using it to abuse something, it doesn't matter. The argument and ends up with one thing: I live for today alone. And you can apply that whenever you're using that attitude. You can apply it to either do good or you can apply it to do horrendous things. If you're living for today alone, then it doesn't matter if you rape, pillage, and plunder. And while all of the people that would ascribe to a Sartian philosophy of existentialism, which is going to wind up leading to nihilism anyway, where there are some people that might be able to apply that to a living an extremely good life. Those people would have to be extremely strong in character, because I'm afraid that with that type of view, the overwhelming majority of people, if they're looking at tomorrow and saying, well, it doesn't matter whether it exists or not, are going to be awfully tempted not to do the proper thing today.
So what you're saying then is that atheism itself is evil. It's not a question of your mother being a neurotic or a frustrated woman who kind of twisted a philosophy and became a celebrity with it. You think atheism itself is an evil thing?
I didn't use the word evil as much as just doesn't work. The Bible calls atheism just foolish, but it is just a philosophy which will not work, particularly for the average man. Now, again, going back to this fellow the other day, it is easy for somebody who has an IQ of 120, 130, 140, who had wealthy upper middle class parents who went to a private school where there was no crime, no violence, no drugs, went to a university, graduated with honors, went and got his master's degree, all paid for by his parents, wound up and got a scholarship and got his PhD, has the wife, the dog, the big house in the valley, and earns $52,000 a year or more $1,000 a week at a state university. It is easy for that individual to sit back and dream up one of these, basically, as I said again, a nihilistic philosophy, and say, well, look how wonderfully it works in my life. Now, go out and tell that to the kid that if he's going to eat today, he's going to have to steal an apple. And tell him that no matter that he has to decide for himself what is right and wrong. You know, there are philosophies that will work on certain economic and social levels, where things like wife swapping is you do that in order to break up the boredom of taking your money to the bank, is quite a bit different from some poor girl who is selling herself on the streets in order to get her next nickel bag of heroin.
How did you become religious?
Well, you know, that was a transitionary a period in my life. It probably took a total of 12 or 13 years, 14 years. It involved political changes, first of all, in my life. And I'm not trying to equate that with religion. Politics and religion is not really an equatable situation. But I got away from my family in 64, 65, and I really wasn't involved on a day-to-day basis with my mother again until 1976. That's 11 years, close to 12 years. And during that period of time, things changed in my life. I discovered things I wasn't hadn't learned at home. I was a violent person. I was raised in a violent atmosphere, and I was violent. During that period of time, I started to calm down. Little bit slowly but surely. I became more conservative in my politics. By that is to say, I went from Marxism to being a liberal Democrat, so I got a lot more conservative in nature. I learned that you could vote for people, and the people that you voted for could win. And I had not known that. I was raised believing that all elections were rigged, and that there was only one political party. And I found out that you could work for an employer for more than 6 months or so, and you'd get a promotion or an increase in pay. All kind of things I hadn't learned at home. I got re-involved with my mother, my family, and with that atheist organization in 1976 when my stepfather was dying, and my mother asked for my help. And I had a lot of reasons for getting involved in that, and As some of them just deaf, some of them perhaps psychological, I don't know, but I wound up back helping her, working with her. And for the next year and a half, I was just personally devastated by what I had gotten myself back into. It nearly finished me off as a human being. By the time my mother was done with me, and her organization was rebuilt, went from having one part-time employee to 12 full-time employees, and went from one three-room office with a bunch of junky old equipment that didn't work to literally a $1 million facility. And by the time my mother was done with me, I was just about ready to crawl underneath a bridge and live. I mean, I was almost in total defeat from that situation. And I could see from this type of philosophy, from the type of individuals, that it was totally wrong, that it went absolutely nowhere, absolutely nowhere. Now, I didn't become religious immediately. What happened is I decided if there was this much evil in the world, then there had to be an equal amount of good. And that if there was and in my mind there had to be some kind of a God, some kind. And to me that was a nebulous belief for a long period of time. I even prayed to this God. I had no idea what he looked like, what he was, or anything else. And it was over a period of 2 years that finally, in 1980, I came to an awareness that indeed not only did God exist, but that he could be and was a personal deity.
Did you ever meet any atheists who weren't associated with your mother? Do you have any sense of people who aren't religious, who outside of the people who belong to your mother's organization?
I have a few, and you know, I had a lady call me on a radio talk show the other day and say, "Bill, you're wrong." She said, "I'm an atheist, and I'm really a nice little old lady and a very moral person." And then she proceeded to use such insults and vulgarity and profanity that she had to be cut off the air by the person. I have tried, but even the people that are nice are so self-contradicting that I picture my mother inside of them, and yesterday was with some folks and they said, "Well, you know, I'm a humanist, and as a humanist, which is an atheist, as a humanist, I believe in taking care of my fellow man, and that killing and that theft is wrong, and I don't believe in adultery or this or that or the other thing, which is all fine, except when I asked them if they ascribe to the things that were in the Humanist Manifesto 1 and 2, they said, "Oh yes, every word in it." And what they had just got done saying was completely contradictory to what was in the Humanist Manifesto. I asked them if they believed the United States government should continue in existence. They said yes. The Humanist Manifesto calls for one world government and the disillusionment of national boundaries. I asked them if they were a Marxist, and they said no, but the Humanist Manifesto calls for redistribution of the means of production and wealth among all people. I asked them, they said adultery was wrong. The Humanist Manifesto says that free sexual conduct between any two consenting people is fine and proper. And it just went on and on and on. And I said, "Well, either you either ascribe to these things, or you shouldn't be calling yourself a humanist. You shouldn't pick up this book and say this is what I believe, unless you too want a socialized form of government with all one world, unless you believe in euthanasia and abortion and complete libertine sex, then you shouldn't do this." And this is why I say, when you ask me, you know, it's different. I've run into people and they say, "Oh, this, your mother couldn't be the same person that you're talking about, because I had dinner with her one time. She's a very fine person." Well, they didn't live with her for 18 years. They didn't see her chase somebody down the street with a knife, or throw plates across the room, or have her sink their teeth into their arm to the point that it required stitches and a tetanus shot. What a person is like. I wouldn't marry somebody because of a dinner date, I'll guarantee you that. But yet I have so many people that tell me I'm wrong about atheism, and tell me that I'm wrong about my mother, because they know an atheist that's a very nice person. And it turns out they've talked to this person for 5 minutes or 10 minutes. And I have difficulty. Now, there's every human variation available in the world. I find it difficult to picture somebody that is an atheist being Christ-like.
Your book is coinciding with a period when the issue of prayer in the public schools is an issue again. It's an issue that's going to come up for a vote again. Is that intentional? Are you campaigning on that issue now? I don't mean crusading, I should say.
Well, the book really wasn't even written initially with the school prayer issue in mind. It was written as a matter of identity, as I said before, what happened in the 60s. Also, it was written for people that were raised in the same type of homes that I was raised in, so that perhaps there could be that identification there that could lead them to an answer that they might not otherwise found.
Where do you stand on the issue?
On the issue itself, I think that the Supreme Court decision has been so misapplied that something has to be done. Now, I think that before we go ahead and amend the basic law of the land, the president could have given the Supreme Court a directive to review its case and make itself more explicit. The Congress of the United States has the authority to pass a jurisdiction act or law ordering the Supreme Court they're called Supreme Court jurisdiction acts. They haven't been used since World War I, when the Supreme Court overturned a sedition law, and the Supreme Court of the United States ordered them the Congress of the United States ordered the Supreme Court not to overturn the law. And not many people realize that the Congress of the United States has the power to order the Supreme Court either not to review an issue or to overturn itself. But there are others, and the reason I'm getting into this complex of a situation with it, the decision has been used in a precedent to do much more than to just stop everybody from getting up in the morning and saying a prayer. In Lubbock, Texas, a group of students were at a bus stop on school property. They were all from the same church, and they were getting together and saying a prayer every morning before they went into the school. They believe that the Supreme Court decision allowed them to voluntarily get together in a group and pray if they wanted to. City attorney pursued the matter, the school board pursued the matter to the point that when they refused to stop the practice, they were suspended. In Harris County, Texas, which has a population of over 3.5 million people, in one of the public parks, a large Christian cross, a Star of David, and the half moon and star of Mohammed were erected in a collage in order to show the respect for those three religions, which are the overwhelming majority, represent 97% of the people in the area. The Murray versus Curlett and Shemp cases were used as precedents in order to legally have those that work of art bulldozed down. What I am saying is this: the issue is much broader than that. I cannot see if the Christian cross is or the Star of David or the half moon of Mohammed is going to become to the point where if you build a church, you have to build a wall around it because you're not going to be allowed to see it from a public place, or if people aren't allowed to use public highways in order to go to church on Sunday.
What's that a reference to?
Well, what I'm saying is that the case has been used as a precedent to actually repress religious beliefs, and that although it hasn't got to when it's just to the point now where we're bulldozing down works of art because they have some semblance of religiosity about them. But if we keep following that logic of separation of church and state, we're going to destroy religion in the country and repress religious beliefs in the name of separation of church and state. So when we go back to this other issue, I personally don't think that putting 30 seconds, amending the Constitution to put 30 seconds or a minute of prayer back into public schools is not going to have that collage reconstructed in that park. It is not going to erase the fact from those students' records that they were suspended for disobeying their principal. It is not going to get Christmas plays or Passover plays or other things back in the schools that have been taken out using this case as a precedent with literally no legal action ever. I believe that if somehow we could get the Supreme Court to redefine their position where it was strictly a matter of the state shall not order any group of people to get up and say a prayer in the morning, that's one thing. But to get to the point where you actually suppress individuals and tell teachers you can't carry a Bible to school or a case in Arizona, it just happened that amazed me. A high school teacher who happened to be a Baptist was at a revival or crusade or whatever you want to call it. And one of her students was there, one of her junior students, and that they had nothing to do with each other than that they were in the same place. The student answered an invitation or call to the front of the altar to pray. The teacher saw the student go down there, so walked down to talk to her. She was fired for using her position of being a teacher in the public schools to influence the girl to accept that particular denomination. She had not taken the girl there. She had not talked to her about answering the invitation. She had not done any of that.
I'm not familiar with the cases that you're discussing, so I can't discuss with you your interpretation of the cases. But if there was a mandatory period of prayer or silent prayer, what kind of pressure would that put on children who are either part of a minority religion in the school or who had none or maybe were born into one but weren't personally religious themselves?
Well, again, this really goes back to some of what I was saying. We have this vision that the entire school has to either pray or not pray at one time, which is, when I went to school, that's not how it was done. I mean, it was broken down into classroom activities. We were in our homerooms 3 minutes in the morning, 4 minutes in the morning, enough for announcements and say the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. I do not see anything wrong with in the morning, half an hour before school starts, that any group that qualifies as a group, that's three or more people, as far as I'm concerned, as a group, that wants to use a classroom in order to worship God in whatever manner that they deem appropriate, whether it takes 5 minutes or 15 minutes, and then go to their regular homeroom classes or their regular classes. I don't see anything wrong with that. I do not see anything wrong with all the Baptists getting together in one room if they want, or the Episcopalians or all the Catholics or all the Jews or all the Muslims. And if there are three Moonies in the school, then they can get together and they can worship however they worship if they want to. And that eliminates a tremendous amount of contention, and it also eliminates the fervor between two large opposing groups as far as prayers in the schools. Unfortunately, what we have now is the contention that if one person prays by themselves, it's fine, but if there's a group and they do it on school grounds, then they're doing it with permission of the school. If the school is giving permission, then the school is in violation of the concept of separation of church and state.
Well, why should they be praying in the schools? The schools are traditionally to learn math and science, physical education, reading,
really?
Other skills.
All right. The first textbooks used in the schools in this country were Bibles. There was not a public school system in the United States until the early 20th century. Harvard was a seminary. So was Yale. So was Princeton. Every institution of learning in the United States that I know of that's more than 50 years old had its foundation in religion. And for the most part, as I said, the textbook was the Bible, and it was the only thing available. And they are not traditionally there, I believe, to teach science and mathematics. Most of the universities that are now famous in this land were, as far as science were concerned, were founded in order to discover how God had put the planet together. So I don't think it's inappropriate. As far as saying that the schools isn't an appropriate place to pray, if this is a free nation, then there is no place that's inappropriate to do anything. If we tell people that they can't get together and use a public building to pray, then we can tell them that they can't get together in a public building in order to practice their political beliefs either. If we refuse to rent a civic or a high school auditorium to a Catholic layman's group, then we can refuse to rent it to the Democrats if the Republicans happen to be in power, or vice versa. If we have freedom in the nation, we have freedom in the nation. If we don't, then let's just say that we don't.
You've been talking earlier about, I should reintroduce you, William Murray is my guest, and he's written a book called My Life Without God, and that's a reference to growing up with his mother, Madeline Murray O'Hare, a famous atheist, and it was her who filed the Supreme Court decision that got prayer removed in the Baltimore public schools. And you've talked about what kind of vicious parent she was and how really neurotic she was, and you've told us that most atheists that you know, that you've really questioned their principles and that you found them to be very hypocritical. I think that the implication is that the Supreme Court decision was based on a very kind of neurotic woman's case. But is that the way you feel, that somehow that... That decision is a function of your mother's craziness?
If it wouldn't have been that particular case, it would have been another one. I wish that it would not have been that one, because it casts doubt on all of the motives of what was going on during that era. The President of the United States on May 17th said... that he's sure that the people that were involved had all the good intentions. Well, I was standing there in the White House lawn and knowing absolutely 100% that that was not true. The people involved did not have good intentions. Their intention was to help bring about the demise of the United States government. But if it wouldn't, I wish that it would have been another case, that there would have been a different type of textbook study, so that the decision would have been written differently, so that it could have been properly applied. I to this day, I can't see where that decision, if properly applied, would stop, let's say, a group of Christian students from putting on an Easter play so that those students who wanted to come and see it could. I don't see how that decision can really be utilized in order to stop that. If an atheist wouldn't have been involved in that case, maybe it wouldn't have been. Maybe if it would have been a Catholic kid who was being required to read a Protestant Bible every day, or if it would have been a Jewish child who was required to say the Lord's Prayer, and if it would have, the circumstances would have just been different from what they were, we probably wouldn't have lost much of the richness out of our schools. As we have lost, we have gone to great lengths to integrate our schools in order to get blacks into the schools so that the whites and blacks can understand each other and not wind up fighting in the streets. Then we turn around and make the atmosphere in the schools such that all the Catholics take their kids out and put them in Catholic schools, and all the Baptists take them out and put them in Baptist schools, and all the Jews take them out and put them in predominantly Jewish schools. And we wind up leaving the schools without the richness. There are no middle-class kids left in most of the public schools of this nation. And we wind up with almost the same situation we have in Lebanon, which is dangerous, where we have, all the Catholics go to the Catholic schools, all the Protestants go to the Protestant schools, nobody is familiar with each other's beliefs, and all of a sudden these really strange, misunderstood fears start to surface, and then all of a sudden you have the same kind of bloodshed in the streets that we had before we integrated.
You found a lot of hypocrisy in the atheist crusade that your mother led, and now you're very involved with Christianity and with what can you tell specifically, very briefly, like what religion?
I'm a Baptist. I'm a member of a Southern Baptist church, which is greatly misunderstood. People think that all Baptists are white and conservative and bigots, which is not true. There are many blacks in my church, and there are many extremely liberal Baptists and whatever. So that is basically where I'm coming from.
Have you found everybody in your church to live up to the ideals?
Well, that's just it. They're not supposed to. And this is what, the atheists, they come along with all of these tremendous ideas. Oh, I'm here to help my fellow man. I'm here to do this. I'm here to do that, which is a bunch of baloney, but they stand by it and they swear by it. Whereas Christians can honestly say, we are sinners. We know we are not perfect. When we come to know Christ, when we become Christians, that does not mean that we become Christ-like the next day, that we are still sinners. We're going to be sinners, and until the day we die, we're going to continue to make mistakes. We're going to continue to be hypocritical. The only thing that we can do is try to become Christ-like, but we can never become Christ-like. An atheist comes along and says, oh, I know I'm Christ-like. I'm the next thing to God.
That's what atheists say?
I think really that's what it is, because we look at so much of the literature, and boy, you'd think that these people are just the most ideal atheist literature, humanist
literature.
Any amount of it. I guess you haven't seen any.
Well, I'm not familiar with any brochures that give the 10 steps to atheism.
Literature that... and humanistic literature that basically says that if you believe like we believe, then you've reached the epitome on the evolutionary scale of intelligence. And
so you're talking about true believer atheism.
Atheist, right. As far as hypocrites are concerned, they're hypocrites in the church. I had somebody say to me the other day, I'm not going to go to church because there are too many hypocrites there. I said, well, come on in. One more ain't going to hurt.
There are really have been textbooks, I think, written about people who swing from one extreme to another, who've like been very conservative and then been very radical, or vice versa. And in your life, you've been brought up in an atheistic home, and have now, since the age of 33, been very religious. And just as you crusaded before against religion, now you're crusading for religion. Has your credibility been questioned because of that? And do you feel
because
you're
the
having
church,
a hard time taking it seriously?
No, because the church is open to everyone. And as I said earlier, I know people in the church that have been lieutenants in the Hell's Angels, and who have just done horrible, horrible things in their lives. And the Church of Jesus Christ, regardless of the denominational title, is the doors are open. The forgiving doors are open to anyone and everybody.
I want to thank you for talking with us.
Pleasure to be here.
William Murray has been my guest. His mother is the atheist Madeline Murray O'Hare, and he's written a book about growing up in that family called My Life Without God. But he's been religious since the age of 33. And has since founded his own group called the Faith Foundation. And his book, My Life Without God, is published by Thomas Nelson Publishers. It's 18 minutes to 3 o'clock. This is Fresh Air. You're tuned to 91 FM. At about 4 o'clock today, we'll be hearing from Stan Waterman, an underwater photographer who's filmed for such films as The Deep, which starred Jacqueline Bisset. At 3:45, Bill Van Wert will review the film An Officer and a Gentleman. And in just a couple of minutes, we'll hear a National Press Club broadcast with President Ferdinand Marcos of the Philippines. First, this is a solo guitar recording featuring Cal Collins. Thank you. Cal Collins featured on guitar. That was Poor Butterfly. It's 12 minutes to 3. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. In about an hour on Fresh Air, our film critic Bill Van Wert will be with us to review the film An Officer and a Gentleman. President Ferdinand Marcos of the Philippines is in Washington, D.C., and earlier today he addressed the National Press Club. Coming up, tape delayed from National Public Radio, we're going to hear his address to the press club, and we'll hear the question and answer period which followed.
Financial support for this program is provided by the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors to this fund include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, for international news coverage, the German Marshall Fund of the United States, RKO General, a radio and television broadcasting company, and for historical reporting, the Pew Memorial Trust. This program is a production of National Public Radio, which is solely responsible for its content.
From Washington, D.C., National Public Radio presents another in the continuing series of broadcasts from the National Press Club. I'm Warren Kozak, and today's guest speaker is Ferdinand Marcos, the president of the Philippines. Now, here's the president of the National Press Club, Vivian Valberg, who will introduce those at the head table, and today's guest speaker.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the National Press Club. I'm Vivian Valberg, president of the club and correspondent for the Daily Oklahoman. Our speaker today is the president of the Philippines, Ferdinand Marcos. It has been 16 years since President Marcos came to the United States on an official visit, and 16 years since we first welcomed him to our podium at the National Press Club. When he appeared before us then, he had just been elected president of the former American colony, which became an independent nation in 1946. We knew Marcos was a war hero. He got so many medals in World War II that when the young Major Marcos met four-star General Omar Bradley, the general saluted him. We also knew he was a persuasive fellow. How else could he have managed to get his wife, who is known to be strong and bright, to marry him after they'd known each other for only 11 days? And we knew he was experienced in overcoming political adversity. After all, the first case Mr. Marcos ever won as a lawyer was when he successfully defended himself from prison against a charge of murdering a political opponent of his father. The president of the press club at that time, Wynn Booth, remarked at the great warmth of the greeting Mr. Marcos received in 1966 and said, and I quote, "Your very presence reminds us that you and your great people are the faithful allies of our country in time of trouble. And that, sir, is something the American people and the men and women assembled in this room are not about to forget," end quote. But much has happened in those 16 years. In the interim, Mr. Marcos declared martial law, or what he called constitutional authoritarianism, and did not lift it for 11 years. There have been charges of corruption, abuses of human rights, and political repression, and recently the Archbishop of Manila called openly for him to resign. But through it all, Mr. Marcos has remained president, and this week, President Reagan warmly welcomed him, stressing the many common ties between the two countries. The New York Times recently said, quote, "In a country that is deeply sensitive to style, Ferdinand Marcos has it, and it has allowed him to take the sweeping actions that in essence converted the nation from an ill-functioning, raucous but free democracy into his personal fief and seemingly personal permanent possession," end quote. President Marcos comes to us today as the head of a nation with a long friendship with the United States, a nation considered crucial to America's defense strategies in Asia. We are eager to hear what Mr. Marcos has to say. It's my pleasure to present to you Ferdinand Marcos, President of the Philippines.